Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, April 20th, 2017. The 19th Eberfest, a gathering of friends. Seen and heard. Here's what caught the eye of Melissa Murley in her 19th year covering Eberfest. The two police horses that dance along with the hippies to Age of Aquarius in New York's Central Park in an opening scene in Hair. Twyla Tharp's blissful and free-spirited choreography for Hair. It blends ballet, jazz, and contemporary styles. The friendly, open-hearted Eberfest guests, among them, seen in the photo at the right with Chaz Ebert, singer Jimmy Demers, Wright, and his pianist brother Donnie, and festival director Nate Cohn's wry humor. Festival opens with rendition of God Bless America, then the film Hair. The 19th Roger Ebert's Film Festival is dedicated to the principles of empathy, compassion, kindness, and forgiveness. But there was another principle or theme in evidence, at least on the festival's opening night, Wednesday, Hair. The five-day event opened at the Virginia Theater with the 1979 movie Hair, prompting University of Illinois President Timothy Colleen to say at the reception before him, "I just wanted to show you that I used to have it, too." He held up a 1960s or 1970s photograph of himself with a full head of hair and a beard. That elicited a big laugh from the sponsors, filmmakers, and other festival guests at the reception at the U of I President's House on what festival director and Urbana native Nate Cohn called a sweltering night. "I think this is the hottest Eberfest we've ever had," he said, as the early evening temperatures hovered around 81 degrees. Enhanced, maybe that's the wrong word, by the odor wafting in from the U of I's nearby South Farms. On a more serious note, Killeen cited the creativity represented by the 100 or so guests at the reception and the sense of legacy left to the campus and community by the late Roger Ebert, an alumnus of the U of I College of Media. "His success also showcased our excellence and the power that a U of I degree holds," Killeen said. "This festival continues to draw top names in film and the eyes of the world to our campus and community." Chancellor Bob Jones took the podium next for his first Eberfest, saying he was grateful to Chaz Ebert for continuing to bring the signature event here. Like Killeen, Jones said the festival puts the university in Urbana-Champaign on the world map. He also said that unlike others at the reception, he was not fortunate enough to have met Roger Ebert. "He really did change the way many saw and thought about movies. He made it okay for everybody to be a critic and have a perspective. He taught us the most important opinion is our own." Jones also quoted Martin Luther King Jr., "We're inextricably linked whether we like it or not." Though not quoting King, Chaz Ebert, the festival MC and executive producer, built on that idea later when taking the Virginia stage to open the festival. "It's so important in this political world that we find ourselves in that we remember that we are our brother's keeper. We are our sister's salvation. We're all in it together." She then said she would open the festival in an unusual way by having a festival guest, Jimmy Demers, sing God Bless America, one of her late husband's favorite songs. She told everyone to stand as Demers came on stage. "Wow, a standing ovation before I sing," he joked. "Thank you, I hope I earn it." He then gave a dramatic, somewhat stylized a cappella rendition of God Bless America. He earned the appreciative applause and whoops. Chaz Ebert said the Eberfest audience is open-hearted and open-minded and feels like part of her family. So she said happy birthday from the stage to Nancy Dawson, who in February is married to Matt Zoller Seitz, editor-in-chief of RogerEbert.com and the TV critic for New York Magazine. Dawson is the sister of Seitz's late wife, Jennifer, who died in 2006. Chaz Ebert then got down to the opening film, introducing Michael Houseman, first assistant director on Hair. Directed by Milos Forman, Houseman, a native New Yorker, has enjoyed a nearly four-decade collaboration with Forman, having worked on a number of films with him. Among them Ragtime and Amadeus, which won 8 Academy Awards. "This is such a nice festival. I want to come back," Houseman told the Eberfest audience, adding that some of his other films could be shown. I've been to a lot of festivals, and this is so well organized. He said Hair was an interesting yet difficult movie to make. It was shot in New York and Los Angeles. I think it holds up, he said. Roger did give it 4 stars. I think it's contemporary. That's why we made the movie, and it says something about the world today. Michael Butler, producer of Hair, was introduced at the reception earlier, but was not on the Virginia stage for the introduction of the film. He was the force that brought Hair in 1968 from the Shakespeare Free Theater to Broadway, Chaz Ebert said. Butler, known then as the hippie millionaire, has produced 31 productions of Hair, among them the 2000 version in Los Angeles that was voted the best musical in the city that year. Active in many arenas, including politics, Butler became in the mid-60s the first chancellor of the Lincoln Academy. In 1987, he opened the Academy's laureate with Order of Lincoln, the highest honor given to Illinois residents. Christie Clinic Illinois Marathon, a legend at going the distance. Veteran marathoner Dick Beardsley taking part in this weekend's event. The Christie Clinic Illinois Marathon has a guest and speaker who has run a couple of the most famous long races ever. Dick Beardsley matched favorite Alberto Salazar almost stride by stride in 1982, one of the last marathons dominated by American runners. The duel in the sun, which Beardsley lost by seconds. I got outkicked in the last 100 yards, he recalls. Just the year before, in an inspiring show of sportsmanship, he and Norwegian Inga Simonsen intentionally crossed the finish line together, holding hands in a time of 2:11:48 in the first London Marathon. Beardsley, 61, is the only man to have ever won 13 consecutive personal bests at the marathon level. So the Bemidji, Minnesota farm boy knows about personal bests, and he says the Illinois Marathon on Saturday might be a good place to get one. Beardsley, the 2017 guest legend at the marathon, will appear at expo events, give a talk at 2 p.m. Friday in the ARC Auditorium, 201 East Peabody Drive, Champaign. Give another talk at 6 p.m. Friday, also at the Activities and Recreation Center, and co-host the Illinois Radio Group pre-race radio show at 5 a.m. Saturday. It's his second trip here. I was down here for the very first event and couldn't believe how big it was for a first time out, he said. Beardsley, who peppers his speech with Minnesotese, including a lot of gollies, got into distance running late and not for the purest of reasons. When I was in high school, I was so into fishing and hunting, but girls started coming into the picture, he said. So I went out for football. I lasted less than an hour on the roster. I figured a letter might be easier in cross country. But cross country turned out to be a bit of a challenge, too. The first day of practice, we ran around 2.5 miles. I had to walk about a mile. When I at least finished, I thought, yeah, I made it, he recalls. But he turned out to be a natural and moved into collegiate competition. In college, it seemed like the further I ran, the better I got. Every coach got me better, he says. At 21, Beardsley ran the Paavo Nurmi Marathon in Hurley, Wisconsin, a Boston qualifier. I ran 2:47, so I was really happy, because I'd never run like that before, and I started a string of new personal bests. In 1979, I hooked up with New Balance, and they set me up for the London Marathon, which was a pretty big deal for a Minnesota boy, he says. That's where he and Simonsen had their dual finish, and Inga and I are great friends to this day. As for Boston 1982, where he and Salazar ran pace for pace far ahead of the rest of the racers, I remember that race like it happened yesterday. It was the first really big, really nice day in Boston all spring, and the fans were out there in droves. Until about the 22-mile marker, most people were cheering for the hometown hero. But later they were cheering for both of us, two young American boys going out against each other, he remembers. He started kicking before I did, and I ran out of room to catch up. Achilles heel problems kept him off the 1984 Olympic team, he says. I went to the 88 Olympics thinking that would be my last hurrah. I didn't make it and moved back to my dairy farm. That was where his running took its truest turn for the worse. In 1989, he had an accident with a shaft on a tractor. I got wrapped up in that thing, and I was lucky I didn't die. It nearly took my leg off, and I had a punctured lung, he says. Both he and Salazar had problems in the next few years. Salazar had a heart attack and a serious bout with depression. He also faced doping allegations. Beardsley became dependent on the painkillers he took for the tractor accident and eventually started a foundation to combat the nationwide problem. He has had two knee replacements, one in 2009, the other in 2010, but still runs 45 to 50 miles a week. Now he has a lifelong view of the marathon. Boston will always have a special place for me, but I like Illinois, he says. It's a nice flat course. That has its pluses and minuses. The nice thing about having hills is you use different muscle groups uphill and downhill, and it gives your other set of muscles a chance to rest. But flat courses are usually fast. University of Illinois, still time for Obama to come. U of I teases Tuesday announcement of 17 commencement speaker. Less than a month before the big day, there's still no official speaker for the University of Illinois commencement, with an invitation to former President Barack Obama still pending. The U of I's Twitter account fueled speculation Wednesday by tweeting that the speaker would be announced April 25th. May want to pick up extra tickets for commencement this year, sharing who our hashtag Illinois 2017 speaker is April 25th! Exclamation point. The U of I formally invited Obama last fall to speak at the May 13th commencement at Memorial Stadium. Students launched a campaign to persuade Obama to say yes with a Facebook page, Twitter account, and hashtag, online petition, video messages, and letters. U of I senior Alex Villanueva, one of several student senators coordinating the campaign, said Wednesday that he has been fielding lots of will he or won't he questions in recent days. I am not at liberty to say, Villanueva said. Everything is going to come out on April 25th. President Robert Jones extended the invitation to Obama via attorney Michael Stropmanis, a U of I alumnus and vice president of the Obama Foundation in Chicago. He was formerly chief of staff for Obama, advising Valerie Jarrett. Messages left with the foundation Wednesday were not returned. Students argued that it's the perfect time for Obama to return to Illinois and celebrate with a flagship university, which turned 150 this year. A change.org petition has collected more than 3,100 signatures. Last year, Obama spoke at Rutgers, Howard, and the Air Force Academy. He gave a total of 23 commencement speeches as president, including 1 year at a military academy and two at the other Big Ten schools, Michigan in 2010, Ohio State in 2013. Michelle Obama, an Illinois native, gave three commencement speeches in her final year as First Lady: the City College of New York, the city's oldest public college, Jackson State, a historically black school, and the Santa Fe Indian School in New Mexico. U of I student president Ron Lewis, who posted his letter to Mr. Obama on Facebook, said Wednesday he hadn't heard any news. Last year, the U of I announced its commencement speaker on March 31st. Former Google executive Jeff Huber, CEO of Grail, a biotech company developing a new blood test to detect early lung cancer. Marcus Jackson, About Town. Namesake's a lot to live up to, but Thor Peterson's power is in conserving energy. Having lived for 47 years with a recognizable first name, Thor Peterson has heard just about every joke or comment there is to be made about being related to the Norse god of thunder. With the emergence of the Thor franchise and the Avengers movie with Chris Hemsworth playing the role of the large, powerful, and bearded man, it's even picked up. Never mind that Peterson pronounces his last name Tor, the H is silent. Comparisons are made no matter how little Parkland College's coordinator of sustainability resembles the fictional character. I certainly don't think at 5'9" I have the physical presence to command with the actual Thor, he said. It's a lot to live up to. Peterson is a bit of a giant in the world of sustainability. He is at Parkland, where in June he'll wrap up his two-year stint made possible by an internally funded grant position. While at Parkland, Peterson said his background in green building to improve the resource conservation on campus focused on energy efficiency as well as water conservation and improving the natural lands around campus. Peterson also spent time with the staff at Parkland helping those at the physical plant keep up to date on the latest energy efficiency technologies. I took it upon myself to work as an internal consultant for our energy folks and give them pointers and make it easier for them to access information around these energy efficiency ideas, he said. One of Peterson's pet projects, though, is something he hopes will continue to thrive after he's gone. He helped initiate an idea called the Green Revolving Fund, which is an internal financing mechanism for energy-efficient projects. Because of some energy efficiency work that has gone on at Parkland the past couple of years, the college received a rebate from the Illinois Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity. And rather than money go back into the general fund, Peterson requested that it be earmarked for the Green Revolving Fund. If money is borrowed from that stash, it must be used for energy efficiency projects on campus, and the money made from those initiatives flows back into the fund. It's really like an internal bank, Peterson said. There's a lightning project running through the fund as a pilot to show proof of the concept and make sure it's functioning the way it should. The results, Peterson says, look promising. We'll be recapitalizing the fund soon with the first round of monetary savings we found on the operating side. My hope is that with structures like that, the Green Revolving Fund, that there will be a financial justification for sustainability improvements here on campus, Peterson said. We're leading with the fact that sustainability is just good business, and prior to the revolving fund, it's just some of those opportunities were skewered by the fact that the upfront cost can dissuade an institution like Parkland from acting on something simply because it's hard to justify an incremental first cost. At Parkland, Peterson had also worked with students, and he serves as an advisor on the Campus Sustainability Club. On Wednesday evening, as part of Earth Week, he hosted a panel discussion featuring five local influential leaders working in sustainability to an overflow crowd at the Parkland Student Union. I do feel like I've accomplished what I would like to here. Certainly, I'd like to do more, and you wish it could happen faster, but it's amazing how quickly 2 years can go by, he said. If I can leave here and say I put in place a mechanism that has institutionalized conservation, then I feel like I've succeeded. I really want to make sure that the business case for sustainability is front and center. Prior to arriving at Parkland, Peterson spent 10 years working for the city of Seattle near his hometown in its green building program. He then worked for a nonprofit that worked to create a leading-edge green building certification called the Living Building Challenge. Then he started a consulting firm doing green building and sustainable community consulting, which he continues while working with Parkland. The plan is to return to the Pacific Northwest once the Parkland appointment expires June 30th. Peterson has enjoyed Champaign-Urbana for its culture, its openness to innovation, and for opening his eyes to sustainability as it relates to agriculture. But the weather, whether it's 90 degrees and humid or below zero and snowing, has taken a toll on this light man from Washington. This is a fantastic community to be a part of, but I think I'm just too used to 52 degrees and raining 11 months of the year, he said. I wilt in the humidity here, and I've never felt cold like this in my life. I can see why Messerners are sturdy folks, because I feel pretty unlike my namesake on that front. Now we have Jim Dye's column. Feds respond to shock blasts with one of their own. Former U.S. Representative Aaron Schock recently filed a lengthy legal motion complaining the federal mole working on his staff not only betrayed his trust but violated his rights by stealing office files and improperly attempting to elicit incriminating information during tape-recorded conversations. Late Tuesday, government lawyers filed an equally aggressive response that argued Schock has no legal grounds to complain and is not entitled to further information from government files as his July 10th trial date at the federal courthouse in Urbana approaches. Dismissing Schock's argument with the title of the famous Frank Sinatra song, Assistant U.S. Attorney Tim Bass quoted legal precedents suggesting that betrayal by an informer is probably inherent in the conditions of human society. In other words, that's life, Bass wrote, quoting both United States versus Jenkins and the title of the iconic crooner's chart topper. The government's motion suggested that Schock's effort to win a dismissal of the wide-ranging indictment against him or the suppression of evidence improperly seized is without merit, the product of a desperate attempt to avoid responsibility for his criminal conduct. Using phrases like inflammatory rhetoric, blunderbuss demand, and increasingly aggressive search for some governmental misconduct claim. Prosecutor Bass argued that Schock has not made even a preliminary showing of wrongdoing by investigators or former Schock office manager and government informant Brian Rudolph. Schock's motion included quoted excerpts of Rudolph's conversational efforts to elicit incriminating information in his recordings with Schock and office employees. The government responded by including several excerpts of Schock's comments, including one in which he advised Rudolph how to answer prosecutor questions in front of a grand jury. When you go into a grand jury, it's yes or no, or I don't remember, because anything you say, they'll get you to lie to a grand jury. What they try and do is trip up the witness, trip up guys like you who have nothing to lose, Schock was quoted as saying. The government's motion stated it may present one or more of the Schock recordings at the trial. It said it does not intend to present in its case in chief any of the recordings with other staff members when defendant Schock was not present unless needed for impeachment. The government also revealed the existence of a heretofore unknown second mole, an unidentified Schock staffer who tape recorded a February 4, 2016 conversation with Schock in which he wanted to discuss and attempt to suggest an inaccurate account of one of the specific matters now charged in the indictment. The government may present this recording or parts of it at a trial, the motion states. The 35-year-old Schock, a one-time rising star in Illinois politics, was indicted in November 2016 on a variety of federal charges, including theft of government funds, wire fraud, tax evasion, and making false statements. A former state legislator who was elected in 2008 to the U.S. House of Representatives from the Peoria area, Schock announced his surprise resignation from the House on March 17, 2015. In the events prior to his resignation, Schock was hit with a series of well-orchestrated informational leaks that generated multiple news stories suggesting that he had engaged in financial improprieties relating to his office spending, they including misstating mileage expenses. The source of those leaks to media outlets has never been identified, but it had to come from someone intimately familiar with Schock's activities and office records. It didn't take long for federal investigators to launch a probe that revealed further improprieties ultimately laid out in the government's 52-page indictment. One of the more interesting charges is that Schock repeatedly took money from his multiple campaign funds, used to purchase tickets to high-profile sporting events, and sold the tickets at a profit to ticket brokers. The government alleged that Schock did not reimburse his campaign accounts or pay income taxes on the proceeds of his ticket venture. Now that the government has responded to Schock's motion, it's up to U.S. Judge Colin Bruce to resolve the issue. There is no indication how much time he'll need to issue his ruling. Schock has requested the government turn over his files related to its relationship with the informant, as well as grand jury transcripts. But the government said not only does the law not require Schock get additional information, but that he's already been given much of what he seeks. Prosecutor Bass said the government has provided discovery materials beyond that which is required, outlining disclosures that total hundreds of thousands of pages of material. Normally a hard-boiled prosecutor, Bass displayed his sensitive side when he suggested his feelings had been hurt by Schock's suggestion that the government has improperly withheld information. He fails to even begin to acknowledge the government's substantial demonstration of good faith in the discovery process since before the indictment was returned, the prosecutor wrote. While denying any suggestion of impropriety on the informant's part, the government said the charge is moot because it does not intend to use any of the material the informant gave investigators. As for Schock's complaints that the informant improperly searched fellow staffers' desks and office files to acquire information to give to investigators, the government stated that there is no expectation of privacy in a public office and that, as the office manager, Rudolph had the right to conduct a consensual search. As office manager, the motion states Rudolph gave himself consent to conduct the search. Since the office manager did not exceed his authority, there simply is no issue, the government states. Area update. Principal at Dr. Howard leaving for MS position. After 2 years as Champaign's Dr. Howard Elementary School, Wendy Starwalt is leaving Unit 4 for the Mohammed Seymour School District. The MS School Board approved a 12-month contract worth $90,000 for Starwalt to serve as pre-K to 2 principal. Her husband, Jeff, is principal at Muhammad's Lincoln Trail Elementary. The pre-K second grade principal position represents a merger of two existing roles. When the new addition to Middletown Prairie Elementary is completed in the fall of 2018, all four of those grade levels will be housed in the same building for the first time in the district's recent history. Starwalt will replace Mark Kabuti, who will retire from Sangamon School this spring. Current Middletown Prairie principal Carol Schallenberger plans to retire the following year. The search for a new elementary principal began earlier this year, led by incoming Superintendent Lindsay Hall and a team of district personnel. That search drew applicants from across the state. MS Director of Special Education Christine Northrup noted that Starwalt oversaw an 80% reduction in disciplinary referrals, as well as a 30% increase in academic growth school-wide, adding that her varied background, which also includes stints as assistant principal in the Unity District and curriculum coordinator in Unit 4, made her a strong candidate. The hiring was the last in a series of administrative job searches undertaken by the district during this school year. In November, Hall was hired to replace the retiring Rick Johnston. In February, the school board picked Nicole Rummel, currently Director of Instruction at El Paso Gridley, for a similar role, replacing the retiring Mary Weaver. Starwalt's hiring creates another principal opening in Unit 4, which in recent weeks hired new leaders for Booker T. Washington STEM Academy, Thea Perkins, Garden Hills Elementary, Beth Ladd, and Westview Elementary, Nick Swords. Still to be filled, openings at Dr. Howard and Centennial High School, with Principal Greg Johnson set to become Assistant Superintendent for Curriculum and Instruction of the Oak Park and River Forest High School District. Paxton City Council vote on pay raises to wait until May. Paxton City Council members will wait until their May meeting to vote on whether to grant a 3% raise in the city's 6 non-unionized employees. If granted, the raises would go into effect retroactive to May 1st, the start of the 2017 fiscal year. The one-year raises would affect the salaries of Police Chief Bob Bain, currently base $56,018, Police Captain Coy Kernett, $45,047, Public Works Director Mark LeClaire, $63,861, Assistant Public Works Director Jeff Ingold, $42,748, Utility Billing Clerk Heather Hale, $31,467, and Comptroller/Treasurer Julie Burgess, $51,105. The raises could cost Paxton about $9,704, Mayor Bill Ingold said. The 3% raises could reflect the same percentage increase granted previously to the city's unionized employees for the upcoming fiscal year, Burgess said. Unionized employees' raises will cost the city about $13,880, Burgess said. This has been Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, April 20th, 2017. Please stay tuned for Part 2.